Hey, Sens fans, this is Stuntman Stu, and you're listening to the Six Sens Podcast.
Welcome back, Sens fans. We're going to do things a little bit differently this week. Tim and I have taken pleasure in booking a number of interviews since there's no NHL hockey going on this week because of the Olympic break. So, Tim, why don't you introduce what we're going to do?
So, to fill the Olympic void this week, we're going to start off with Mr. James Myrtle of the Globe and Mail, one of Canada's best. And then we're going to go on to Norm McIver, Senators legend, single-season point holder for a defenseman. And we're going to finish it off with none other, Graham,
than Gordie Wilson.
I know that's going to be a gem.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic. But we hope you guys enjoyed the interviews. We'll be back next week talking Senators hockey, and we're going to have a great featured guest that week as well. So stick with us. We hope you enjoy the show. All right, listeners, we're back on the line with James Myrtle from the Globe and Mail. James, welcome to the Six Sense Podcast. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for coming on.
All right, James, so you write for the Globe and Mail. That's your 9-to-5. How are you keeping busy over the break?
You know what? Working on the Olympics for the Globe is definitely busy. It's sort of like a... in general, the sports section is like a fairly small part of what the Globe and Mail does, but during the Olympics, it's a big, big part of it. You know, it's on the front page every day. We have a 20-page Olympic session we're putting out every day. So they've just got me in the newsroom, and I'm helping out. I'm, when hockey stories come through, I read them and edit them and stuff like that, and, put together stuff in our Olympic section for the next day. So pretty busy. You know, we're all working 6 days a week, and we're working weekends and pretty late nights. You know, I'm here till 11:30 most nights.
Yeah, I noticed the pullout in the Globe. I think it was Monday, was it? And it was fantastic. Good coverage in there.
Yeah, we're doing that every single day, and for the first time ever, we're publishing on Sundays, which the Globe never normally does. But just for the Olympics, we're doing that. So it's meant that we're here late on Saturday nights too. So
how are you enjoying the Olympic hockey coverage right now?
It's all right. You know, I've been a little bit critical of the Olympic tournament just because, you know, we wait 4 years for this tournament, and then we have matchups like Canada, Norway. Tonight it's Canada, Switzerland. The U.S. played Norway today, and it's unfortunate that it's not that all of the games aren't, you know, Canada, Sweden, Canada, Russia. We could have waited 4 years for this tournament and not see Crosby against Ovechkin at all because they're not in the same group. So it's going to have to fall to the sort of playoff rounds, the medal rounds, for that to happen. So, you know, I'm like everyone else. I'm hoping that we do see that matchup, and it would be really unfortunate if we watched Canada beat the tar out of Norway and Switzerland and then didn't get the chance to play the teams that could give them a real run.
I saw in one of your articles that you wrote that you'd actually like to see a reformatting of the tournament. Maybe you could just educate our listeners who haven't had an opportunity to read your piece.
Yeah, basically what I said is that they should go based on the world rankings. If they want to have a 12-team tournament, what they should do is take the top six teams, which would be, you know, the usual suspects, Canada, Russia, U.S., basically, and then take the next six teams, and they should be in two different groups. They play around robin against each other, so the Canadian and the American team and the Russians and then Sweden would all play five games against all the other top teams. And then basically there's a round robin with the teams ranked 7 to 12, where you have, you know, your Norways and Belarus, et cetera. They play five games each against each other. And then the top two teams out of that second group, out of the sort of weaker teams, the top two teams would move on into a playoff round against those top six teams that are already there. And based on how Canada and Russia and all the other, the Group A sort of teams did, they would get an easier opponent. So say Canada goes 4-1 or 5-0 in their games, then they'll get to play the lowest ranked team, which would probably be, you know, someone like Germany or Switzerland or whoever came out of that Group B. And what that does is it means that Canada and the U.S. and whichever teams are ranked in the top six, they're going to play against all of the other top six teams, and they're not really going to play Norway unless Norway sort of wins their way into a game against Canada.
Do you not think it's important for countries like, a country like Norway to play against the elite teams like the Canadians and the Americans in order to grow their own hockey products?
Yeah, but, you know, Norway played Canada at the 1992 Olympics, and they lost 10-0. And I don't know where we're supposed to see the progress in that happening. I don't know how that makes Norway better by doing that. I think there are a lot of ways they could improve the development of hockey, sort of at the lower levels, get more people playing hockey is one way to start doing that. And I don't see how Norway losing badly to a whole bunch of NHLers really improves the state of hockey in that country at all.
At least it's not as bad as the women's results right now, though.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge problem for the women's game. There's not really a great solution there. Like, at least with the men's side, you've got 6-7 teams that can play and beat each other on any night. When it comes to women's hockey, you know, what are they going to do? There's two competitive teams, and no one else is even close to that.
So, James, do you think that NHLers have a place in Russia in 2014? Will they have time to adjust the tournament to your new system, or could amateurs be brought in?
That's a good question. Yeah, you know, I actually think the NHL probably is going to go, just because there's going to be a lot of pressure on them to do that from guys like Ovechkin and Kovalchuk, and a lot of, you know, the Russian players have a lot of influence now, and but it's going to just have to be something that's negotiated. Should they be there? Yeah, I think they should be there, but the problem is that it's just really tough to cram that into an NHL schedule. What the NHL really should do is have a shorter schedule and have a season that ends before June. With the way it is with 82 games and with the four rounds of playoffs, it's really, really tough to fit in a European Olympics. So my guess is that they cram it in somehow and make it happen, just because guys like Ovechkin are going to threaten to not even play in the NHL.
I guess it hurts the Olympics are
Bettman's argument against going to Russia when NBC isn't even carrying the Canadian-American game, when it's getting preempted for women's figure skating, I believe, that night.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's and they said that, too, is that when the games were in Italy, that it just didn't really register in the U.S. on TV. You know, the games are on at strange times, and they don't get the ratings, and it really didn't give the NHL the boost that they wanted, especially when it's overseas.
James, do you mind switching gears a little bit to the Ottawa Senators?
Yeah, sure.
We're just curious because recently you did an article detailing Daniel Alfredsson's case for the Selke Trophy for the NHL's best defensive forward.
Used a lot of non-traditional.
Like,
yeah, non-traditional is a perfect way to put it. Non-traditional statistic analysis to make a case for Alfredsson. We know you're a big proponent of the Behind the Net website. Why have you thought that the NHL statistical analysis hasn't been that great over the years? Like, I know Sabermetrics has been pretty big in baseball, and it's taken a long, long time to catch up in hockey. Do you see it going far in the future?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think it's way behind baseball. It's years and years. It's decades behind baseball, right? So it's probably something that's. Hopefully there are going to be more guys like me that see this stuff and think that it's useful and it's worth pushing forward. You know, Behind the Net is the best site that's available right now, but he doesn't have a lot of competition. You know, there's not a lot of sites producing new numbers for us to look at. So it's really in its infancy, basically. And I think there are going to be... The thing is that when I write something like that, the response that it gets is incredible. You know, that article is read by thousands and thousands of people. It gets picked up by all the blogs. They pass it around. I go on the radio and talk about it because people are really interested in that, and I think as long as that's there, it's going to keep moving forward. You know, as long as people show that they're interested in that they believe in that kind of analysis and think it's worthwhile, then yeah, for sure. You know, I think the things I've done with picking out defensive forwards and defensive defensemen and things like that, it's work that needs to be done, because realistically, I don't know how you grade how good a defensive forward is and how you vote for the Selke Trophy right now, because plus-minus is just such a limited statistic that it doesn't work. And I was always frustrated, even, you know, when I was a hockey fan, by the limitations that hockey stats have. So it's been great being able to put some of that stuff out there, and I hope it does keep getting more and more popular, because that's something I'm really interested in.
Yeah, so James, you actually just touched on this, but we were talking earlier, Graham and I were having a pretty heated debate between the two of us in the car ride over here about how much money a guy like Anton Volchenkov is going to be worth as a free agent this summer. And it's really hard with a defenseman like that to really qualify his stats when he doesn't really put up the traditional stats. So what do you see for a guy like that in terms of these new stats, debunking some myths about the way players are supposed to play? And like, how do you think that is going to affect the price of defensemen in this capacity going forward? Because we've seen mistakes with guys like Jay McKee, Komisarek.
Mike Commodore,
good one.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Yeah, I don't know if the new stats are really registering, and if that's how, I mean, maybe they are, but they won't tell us. You know, the general managers don't say, the Minnesota Wild signed Greg Zanin because he had stats that were just as good as Mike Komisarek's, but they signed Greg Zanin for a third of the price of Mike Komisarek. I mean, to me, that's a great move, and Zanin's played pretty well on a Minnesota team that hasn't really had a great year. But it's like one of those, you know, there's a move there that not a lot of people talk about because they think who the hell is Greg Zanin, right? But in Volchenkov, you know, he's a guy that's got a somewhat higher profile. He plays for a Canadian team. You know, you see him on Hockey Night Canada a little bit. He's a really, really solid player. And I think his profile is probably one thing that's going to get him a fairly high paycheck. You know, I think you're probably looking in the, I would say, 3.5, more than that, probably $4.5 million. I mean, you look at what guys like Scott Hannon got and Brooks Orpik in Pittsburgh, and he's going to probably fall in that same range. I'd like to think that the new stats sort of have a bearing on that, and Volchenkov's had some great seasons recently, but I don't know.
Tim and I kind of got into that a little bit too on the car ride over, obviously. We were drawing comparables, and most of the guys who've signed over the last few years as defensive defensemen, they have a tendency to get banged up or become, you just look back in retrospect and you say, oh, that guy was kind of overpriced. Like a guy like a Jay McKee signed in St. Louis for $4 million a season. And he was bought out before his contract was over. So it's just, I guess it's just kind of a difficult situation to envision your team, your favorite team, overpaying to bring a guy in who might not be like a healthy, I guess there's a lot of health risks associated with these kind of players as well.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, you're right, because, yeah, they play such a physical role, it takes a toll on them. And even like a guy like Volchenkov, I mean, he's a perfect example of how some years he just has a great season for whatever reason, and then I think it was last year, right, that he sort of struggled a little bit in that role, and then now this year he's been good again. So it's just a matter of, it's really tough to grade defensive players, and just the way, you know, an offensive guy can have an off year and score 20 goals instead of scoring 35 or whatever. I mean, it can happen to defensive players too. So it's a lot of it's based on the myth sort of around these guys. Like I think like Komisarek, I already said this, but I think he got paid way too much. I think McKee's in the same situation, and you just can't pay a guy because he hits a lot or he blocks shots. You want to pay a guy who plays good defense, and you know the numbers don't really matter in terms of the traditional numbers. What matters is that the puck stays out of your net when the guy's on the ice, and that he can play against Ovechkin or whoever the star is on the other team when you're facing that team.
So as a big picture, James, to the best of your knowledge, do NHL clubs employ individuals that monitor these stats and that consider them, at least on a consulting basis? And even further, should NHL teams be employing these types of people and acknowledging the existence of these stats and their worthiness?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they can give me a call.
Hey, work for Bill James.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think there are a couple teams doing it, but you know, it's just sort of you hear rumors or you know, like I said, they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to give away the advantage that they think they have by doing this. But I think Dean Lombardi, who's the GM in LA, I think he's a proponent of doing this. And I know even, yeah, I talk to Gabe Desjardins regularly, who runs Behind the Net, and he's talked to teams. You know, teams have come up to him and said, can you do some work for us or whatever? And I don't think he's really found a fit for where he wants to do that. But there's starting to be more awareness about stuff like that. And another team that did something like that was that the Minnesota Wild hired Chris Snow, who's a guy who's in his mid-20s. And was actually a journalist, and they just really liked the way he looked at baseball and hockey and wrote about it, and they decided he could add something to their team. So it's sort of thinking outside the box a little bit by bringing in different types of people and analyzing the game in new ways. And I think that you're seeing that with some teams, but, you know, as long as the Red Wings are winning with great scouting and the way that they've won, it's probably not going to be a story until we see a team like the LA Kings win and the secret comes out that Dean Lombardi's been using advanced statistics the whole time to build that team. So you know, I can see that definitely coming. I just don't know when.
Well, it certainly be a breath of fresh air for all hockey fans to have something new to gravitate towards.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, yeah. And what's interesting is that it's been the blogosphere that's really been pushing it forward because there's still not a lot of it in the media yet. I'm hopeful that as I write for the Globe and do the Leafs stuff that I can get more of that stuff into the paper.
Well, if Dean Lombardi becomes the new Billy Bean of hockey, we'll be sure to point to you as the reason why. But so there are 20 games left in the regular season, obviously. As an outsider looking at the Senators' situation, where do you envision Ottawa, and how successful do you see them being towards the playoffs and into the playoffs?
That's a good question. They've actually really surprised me this year. I didn't know. I would have had them as sort of one of the bubble teams in the Eastern Conference, but they've been quite a lot better than that so far. So it's going to be interesting. I don't think the Eastern Conference is particularly strong other than the top two or three teams. And I think Ottawa is just like one notch below that. And I think they've got a pretty decent chance in the East as long as they keep playing like that. I think Corey Kluston's done a really nice job with the Senators.
Okay. So have you, looking at Pascal LeClaire, he has one of the worst value ratings on behindthenet.ca. Are you surprised by this a bit because of his injury history?
No, I'm not a big Pascal LeClaire fan. I never was. I didn't really like that trade that much. And they're really lucky that Brian Elliott's played as well as he had. I mean, that's really bailed them out, because if not, then they wouldn't be a playoff team. And that's part of the reason I didn't pick them to be a playoff team, is I didn't think Pascal Leclerc could get it done. He had one good year in Columbus, but for the most part, other than that, it's been pretty ugly. And he's going to have a really hard time living up to that contract, for sure.
Yeah, I'm certainly starting to believe that sentiment, James.
Yeah, well, if you look back when they made that trade, I was not very gung ho on that. I mean, I think Anton Vermette's a more useful player than Leclerc. I mean, he's not a superstar by any means, but you know, it's a solid defensive forward, and he's a guy I'd rather have on my team than Leclerc. And you look now, and you look at next summer. There's going to be so many starting goalies available to be signed. There aren't a lot of great free agents, but there are a lot of great goaltenders that are going to be available. So, you know, they could have just waited.
Yeah, so we don't want to keep your editor waiting there, James. Hopefully you can get back and turn out some quality Olympic material for us to check out in the papers over the next few days.
Yeah, and read some figure skating stories.
But what do you have coming up on the blog?
I don't know. I just sort of, I'm trying to, just whenever I get the urge to write something, I come up with it. I'm doing a little bit of writing on the NHL at the break, just looking at stats and stuff like that. It's going to be interesting because as soon as we come out of the Olympics, it's going to be the trade deadline, and it's going to be really, really busy. And I'm hopeful that what we're going to do at the Globe is I'm going to be full-time on the hockey blog at the Globe and just churning as much stuff out as possible on the trade deadline day, because I think it's going to be really busy. It's going to be really interesting. So probably in the lead up to that, I'm going to have all kinds of trade deadline related stuff as soon as the Olympics is over.
Great. Well, we look forward to it. And we want to thank you very much for coming on the show today, James. It was an absolute pleasure. And to all our listeners out there, if you want to hear more from James Myrtle, you can check out his website at myrtle.blogspot.com, the Globe Sports, and the Globe Sports blog, too. So there you go. Lots of ways.
Thanks for coming on, James.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. Paperback writer.
All right, listeners, we're back on the line with Norm McIver, the Senators record holder for points by a defenseman, and he is the Director of Player Development for the Chicago Blackhawks. Norm, welcome to the Sixth Sense podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, Norm. Sorry off the bat, we'll just address the elephant in the room. You're the points holder for a defenseman in Ottawa, 63 points, 17 goals, 46 assists. Yeah, and this record still stands today. Are you surprised at that, or were you really just that good?
You know, I didn't even realize it until you just said it right now. I guess I am surprised. I honestly didn't know that it was still a record. You know, it's I guess maybe the game has changed. Maybe it was easier to get points back then, but yeah, it wasn't because I was that good. But I just got I was fortunate that year to get some points, but. I am actually very surprised that it's still a record.
Going back, was it difficult to play for an expansion team? Obviously, as an offensive defenseman, you didn't exactly have a strong supporting cast.
You know, it was a little difficult, but you know, the one thing about the expansion team back then, you know, we The expansion teams that have come since, they've all sort of played the same style. They came in and they started to do the trap. The trap sort of became in vogue in the mid-90s, whereas back in the early 90s, as it was in the 80s and late 80s, most of the teams all played a very aggressive 2-1-2 forecheck, where they forechecked hard and they tried to create offense and they tried to outscore other teams. And so that was kind of our mentality. We tried to be an aggressive team and we tried to forecheck. The problem was we just didn't have enough talent to score, and because of the amount of scoring chances we gave up playing that style, more often than not, we gave up quite a few goals. But, we did play a style that you could get points playing, because we were very, very aggressive.
Looking back at the stats, like, we looked at Peluso's numbers, we couldn't believe he actually had 15 goals that year, so...
And how many penalty minutes?
Yeah, 318 or something, yeah. Just wild. What were your fondest memories of Ottawa, looking back at that first season?
Obviously it was tough losing like we did, but for me personally, obviously statistically it was a pretty good year for me. You take away the plus minus, but from a goals and assist standpoint, it was pretty good. It was funny because the year before I had probably my best year of my career at Edmonton, and then I had gotten into a little bit of a contract situation with Edmonton and held out a training camp, and I was under the understanding that 92 season in that training camp that I was going to be protected in the waiver draft, and that I was going to be sort of, not going to be able to play hockey until I came an agreement with the Oilers. And when the waiver draft came, I wasn't even aware that I was put on waivers, and that I got a phone call at my house from John Ferguson's secretary, and I didn't know who John Ferguson was working for. And it wasn't until after I actually got on the phone that I actually had to ask what team was it that I had got picked up by. So it was sort of a strange thing. And then I got to Ottawa with no training camp, and I had one practice and got thrown in there in the first game. And we won that first game. That was probably the highlight of the year, was that opening night beating Montreal. And it was just a great atmosphere. And it was fun that night. Unfortunately, we didn't have too many nights like that. But, I enjoyed the city of Ottawa. I love living there. And all in all, I look back, it was a great experience for me.
So you mentioned the fact that the Senators lost so many games in that inaugural season. I guess it was, 70 games that year? How hard was it for you and for the team as a collective to go to the rink with the right mentality every day and perform for the fans?
Well, obviously we really struggled on the road. I think at home we were fairly competitive at home. We didn't win that many games, but we were fairly competitive for the most part. And the fans were great. I loved playing in that rink, and as did most of the players. It was just a very difficult situation. We obviously knew we were outgunned most nights, but if we did get a team that was sort of near the bottom of the league, it was amazing how much more confident the team we were. Just knowing that, okay, we might have a chance to win tonight. And but it was tough when you played the Pittsburghs and the Montreals, the teams that were the top of the NHL back then. It was tough going in there knowing that they're probably going to score six or seven on you. And that's part of the expansion deal. And you just have to deal with it. The other thing is too, as the season went on, guys started realizing that they were really playing for contracts and for their future. And so that's one thing about the guys on that team. They played hard every night, and because, most guys were either at the end of their career or the beginning of their career, and they wanted to either stay in the NHL or to maintain a career in the NHL. So we certainly had a lot of guys that played hard, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, take no look further than guys like Darcy Loewen and Mike Peluso for definitions of work ethic on the ice, right? I mean, those guys just epitomized it.
And Jody Hull stuck around for a long time in the league as well.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there were other guys. Those guys, for example, Mike went on to win a Stanley Cup with New Jersey and was a big part of that team. So, guys did. And Jody as well played for quite a few more years. And, Jamie Baker went to San Jose. And, there were other guys as well. So, Bradshaw. So, it was the one thing about that team. They played hard. We did the best we could. We just weren't very talented.
Was it fun to sit on the bench and then play the game and realize that you had Mike Peluso covering your back every night?
you know, Mike, yeah, that was a tough job. I those guys that do that, that's something that I would never want to do. Or it was very, very difficult to see those guys have to do that. And that's, you know, but that's part of the NHL. That's certain players have a role. And but Mike was a tough customer, and boy, he took on everybody. That's for sure.
Absolutely, and we loved him for it. So after a couple of rough years in Ottawa, you must have had some great times with the guys in the locker room. Do you have any good stories that really stick out as being particularly memorable? Stories that you'd share on air. We can be clear about that.
Well, that's a good question. One was pretty. I mean, obviously the losing was tough, and Rick Bonus, who is just one of the. I mean, he's one of the nicest men you're ever going to find. But Rick also had the other side of him when he was coaching. He was very intense, and every once in a while he could sort of. Blow a gasket, I guess that's a nice way of putting it. And one game we had a player that year, Thomas Jelinek, who was from Czechoslovakia, and it was his one and only year, I believe, that he played in the NHL. But Tommy had some sticks, and I know that they were really illegal. I mean, he had some big curves on those sticks. And one time Rick came in between periods, he was a little upset at Thomas for something. I don't remember what it was, but he grabbed all of his sticks. We had a stick rack as you walked in the dressing room. There was a stick rack there, and players had all their sticks up there that they weren't using in the game. And I remember Bones, Rick came in there, and he was a little upset, and he grabbed every one of Thomas's sticks and broke every single one of them. And so it was sort of a message to Thomas and the rest of us. But that was one of the stories I could tell on there. There were some others, but I don't know if I want to share those with everybody.
That's good.
There were a few, and there were a few things that happened during the course of that year, but that one stood out. It was actually kind of, you didn't want to laugh at the time, but afterwards it was pretty funny.
Yeah. Now that you've moved on from your playing career, you're now the director of player development in Chicago. I guess you were hired in July of 2008. How did you come to get into that role of hockey off the ice?
Well, when I retired, I got into coaching, and I coached for 6 years, and actually coached a couple of years, the assistant coach for 2 years in Boston with the Bruins, and then the whole staff, we were let go in the 07, the start of the 07-08 season, and I actually did some pro scouting for the Senators that year when John Muckler was the GM. I was based here out in Minnesota, and I was... just doing the Minnesota Wild games, but I was still being paid by the Bruins, so to give me something to do, John was very gracious enough to give me the opportunity to do some pro scouting for them. And I did that for a season, and then after John was let go, I was looking for something to do, and around Christmas of the 07-08 season, I got in contact with Dale Talon and the Blackhawks, and started out doing the player development. Actually, I started in January of the 08 season, so it's been almost 2.5 years now, I guess, that I've been with the Blackhawks.
Yeah, well, I guess it's no big surprise to anyone who watches hockey that Chicago's undergone a huge transformation over the past few years, and that started with good drafting, followed up by becoming a destination for free agents. It's an exciting team on the ice, and the quality of play is a testament to the drafting and the development of the players. How rewarding is it for yourself personally and for the staff as a collective to see this kind of product on the ice now?
Well, it's very rewarding to see the product. I mean, I'm certainly not going to take any credit for any of it, but
oh, go ahead.
It's very rewarding. I mean, it certainly has been, very good drafting, as well as some very, very good free agent pickups. And like you said, I think the one thing that's changed more than anything is that, we hope that the perception is that Chicago is a destination that players want to come. I mean, if you're a free agent, hopefully we've created an environment there now that that players, when they talk to players that are with the Blackhawks now or that have played in the last year or so, that the feedback is always, yeah, that's the place you want to play. I mean, you get treated, you get treated first class, and they do things first class, and off the ice and on the ice, but also the style of play. They play an up tempo puck possession game that benefits players with skill. And the other thing is the building. I mean, the building is alive. It's electric. It's a place that you know, it's the place to be in Chicago right now. It's, you know, they've got, I don't even know what, it's over 80-some-odd games consecutive sellouts, and it's just, it's a happening in Chicago. And so, you know, all those things have really made it a great place to play and an attractive place for players to play. And you know, so now it's up to us, you know, people like myself and the amateur scouts to continue to draft well and to develop players so that we can keep this going, because we all know in the salary cap world that the NHL is in right now, it's difficult to keep a nucleus of young players together because of the salary cap. So it's more important than ever that we draft well and develop players well so that we can continue this style of play and this thing we have going on in Chicago coming, you know, going forward.
I think the single biggest reason for anyone to want to play in Chicago, I can't believe I forgot to mention this earlier, is those fantastic jerseys, too.
Yeah, they are. They are the, you know, they are the, in my opinion, they're the nicest jerseys in the NHL. It's, you know, they're just a great jersey, and unfortunately, I never got a chance to put one on as a player, but it's nice when I go to the games and you see those. They are awesome.
Norm, from a player development standpoint, Tim and I were talking about this a bit before you came on, and we were discussing Erik Karlsson, who's a small offensive-minded defenseman of the Ottawa Senators right now, and I guess the kind of trend that we've noticed is that there seems to be a bit of a renaissance in regards to the NHL in the fact that they're kind of shying away a bit from the size, and there's more emphasis on skill. Do you get the same vibe?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the strength of our team in Chicago right now, I mean, the biggest strength we have is the mobility and the speed and the skill in the back end in our defense. And it's really, you know, along with you know, Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews, I mean, certainly up front and now with Marian Hossa, but, you know, the back end, the speed, the quickness, and the skill of our defense is what's really sort of propelled our team from an average team into you know, what we think is an elite team. And so, you know, if you go around the NHL, I mean, that's, to me, that's the area, the teams that have the defense that have the skill and the mobility to be able to move the puck quickly. I mean, it's a different game. It's so much faster now. The rules have dictated that speed and skill are at the forefront. And, you know, so therefore less emphasis on size and more emphasis on speed and skill. And, you know, you still have to have a mixture, obviously, in your lineup. You can't just have all of one or, you know, one or the other. You have to have a little combination of both. But certainly it allows for a lot more smaller skilled players to play in the NHL than it did maybe 15 years ago.
One of the comparisons, actually, that was drawn to Karlsson, I was talking to Bruce Firestone, actually, before I think it was yesterday, and he mentioned, actually, you as a comparison to Karlsson, just in the sense of how he operates the power play. So that's why I brought up Karlsson earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. I saw the Senators play earlier this year, but he was not. He did not play the game that I saw. So I haven't seen him. I have not seen him play personally. But I've certainly heard from our pro scouts. You know, I've heard reports from them, and obviously they're very impressed with his play and with his potential.
Oh, absolutely. He's definitely got a long ways to go, though, before he gets to 63 points in a season. But I think if anyone that the Senators have had on that blue line over the past, 10 years, Karlsson might be the guy to do it. I know that's high hopes for him, but hopefully.
Yeah. I'm sure someone pretty soon is going to get that past that mark, that's for sure.
So as the Blackhawks continue to improve, it makes your job a little bit easier, right? I mean, or a little bit harder, rather. You're not holding those premium draft slots that you once had. How hard is it to manage, you know, all your future assets while ensuring that the club stays competitive for that, you know, I guess somewhat small window that's been created by the, quote, new NHL salary cap era?
Well, yeah, that's why, you know, the way we're looking at it, that the drafting and the player development is going to be vital for us. I mean, we have guys, it's no different than other teams, but we have guys now that are signed to long-term contracts. They're not going anywhere. They're signed for, in some cases, you know, 12 years, in other cases, 6 and 7 years. So we know that there's a core of guys that are going to be there long-term. And so, but we also are fully aware that there's going to be a lot of turnover because the guys that are there long-term, the other guys that are there short-term, if they improve to the point where, whether it's through arbitration, whatever, you're going to have to pay them, and we can't afford to pay them, then they're going to have to move for other assets. So that means, you know, we're going to have to continually draft well and develop well so that that we can keep the turnover going, but also not lose, you know, not lose our status as one of the top teams in the NHL. So player development and scouting are, for our organization, are going to be vital to keep this thing going because of the fact that we do have so many players signed to long-term contracts, and that basically they are the core of the team, and it's now it's just going to be a matter of surrounding that core, but continually surrounding them with good players, and that's hopefully that's our objective, and that's what we're going to try to do.
Yeah, it's certainly a tight rope to walk when you get into that situation.
Is there a prospect within the Hawks system who you're maybe not, they might not be like the most renowned prospect, but is there someone in the system right now that you're really, really proud of?
Well, I mean, you know, from my standpoint, with the college kids, it's difficult. I don't necessarily get to work. You know, what I do more or less is I monitor the kids. You know, I go around and watch them, and I'll report back to the team. And, you know, I give the players feedback on certain things, but I don't get too involved during the course of the season just from the standpoint that, you know, I like to let them enjoy where they are, and I don't want to interfere with what their coaches are telling them and what they're doing with them. So my feedback that I give the players is more long-term information, things that they have to do long-term to improve and to develop and hopefully to reach the NHL. So I don't necessarily get overly involved with the players in terms of their, you know, what they're doing or things they need to do. I give them sort of a long-term outlook, and then obviously we have to let the coaches, the teams they're playing on, we have to let them coach them. So, you know, I mean, it's more of a monitoring thing that I do and than actually getting on the ice and working with these kids and really giving my two cents on what I can do with them. Although on the American League level, I could certainly do that. I get on the ice and I work with guys at the American League level. But getting back to your question, I mean, if there's anyone that that maybe people don't know about or that someone that we're really happy with is having a terrific year, the kid Brandon Peary in RPI, who we drafted in the second round last year. And, you know, we think this guy's got a really, really bright future. And, you know, he's a ways away from playing in the NHL, but, you know, he's a kid that we think that someday could not only play in the NHL, but be an impact player in the NHL.
Typically, Tim and I, when we do our interviews, we have a rapid-fire segment. So what we're going to do is just throw a couple of quick sentences to you, and we're just looking for a quick answer. All right. Best hair on the inaugural Senators team?
Mike Peluso.
Easy answer. Best part about living in the city of Ottawa?
You know, I really enjoy just driving around Parliament area, especially at Christmas time.
What do you prefer, the old Senators 2D logo that you wore, or the new 3D version that we have now?
The old one.
Have you ever had a pool party at Mary Lemieux's house?
No.
When will your record for points by a defenseman fall with the Ottawa Senators, if ever?
Next year.
Oh, you're selling yourself short. Well, Norm, thanks for coming on the podcast. Tim and I really appreciate having you on. We hope you enjoyed your time.
Absolute treat, Norm.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Norm. All right, listeners, we're back on the phone with Gord Wilson, the color guy for the Team 1200. Gord, welcome to the Sixth Sense podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me, boys.
He really doesn't need an introduction, does he? Just the name itself just resonates Ottawa Senators hockey.
No,
yeah, right.
All right, Gord. So we're at the Olympic break. How do you evaluate the first three quarters of the season for the Senators?
Well, an interesting one, to say the least. Certainly the last quarter has been an outstanding quarter for Ottawa, winners of 14 of their last 16 games. Who'd have thunk it? I don't think anybody would have predicted that this team would have gone on the run that it has gone on. And when you think about it, and if I can gas on here for a minute or two, when you think about today's National Hockey League and everything that works against a team, and I mean all 30 teams in the league, everything that works against a team in trying to put together a streak, a consecutive run of victories, it's remarkable to think that any team could win 7 or 8 or 10 or 14 or 15 games like the Washington Capitals did, and certainly the 11 from the Ottawa Senators is, in my opinion, just as remarkable. You know, you talk about the schedule, and every team has complained about that. You talk about injuries, and every team has gone through their share of injuries. And then you talk about the parity in the National Hockey League, and every team, every coach will tell you it is as tough to win today as it's ever been in the National Hockey League. So you combine those three factors with a team trying to put together a streak, and a team that though goes on an 11-game run is a pretty remarkable run, in my opinion, when you factor in those three things that I just mentioned. So the first three quarters of the season have been pretty interesting, to say the least, and certainly I think the way the Senators are playing going into the final 19 games, the break probably came at a wrong time for them, but they've also got three or four players that need the time off to rest some bumps and bruises and some aches and pains, and it should be the team should come back as a fresher, probably a little bit stronger hockey club.
Oh, absolutely, and a lot of people in Ottawa and elsewhere have been quick to point out that this squad, maybe not the most talented group the Senators have ever put together, but they're certainly making a case for being the most resilient. How would you comment on that?
Yeah, no, it's a good point that you bring up here. Resilience is one thing, but I think, you know, one of the things that this team has shown as well, and there was a real emphasis on this word back in the summertime when the hockey club went through the Danny Heatley ordeal, the word team was stressed and emphasized every day. And whenever you heard Brian Murray talk about the Heatley scenario, he always stressed the word team. Whenever Corey Clouston was asked about the Heatley scenario, he always emphasized the word team. And it's been that way since that offseason, since last offseason, certainly in training camp, certainly throughout the five-game losing streak, the lousy road trip out west, and then that was followed up by a five-game losing streak. It was always talked about the team not doing something, and when this team went through some lousy goaltending, a period of lousy goaltending, and let's face it, goaltending is everything in this league, and when the team wasn't getting the saves, the team was still playing fairly well enough to win hockey games. They just weren't getting the goaltending to help win those games, but there was never one singling out of an individual or one particular position. It was always, you know, the team just needs to do a little bit more, find a little bit more to overcome, and it's done that. So resilience is one word to describe how this team has performed, but I think the chemistry that has developed in the locker room is something that should be noted as well.
Getting back to your team point, I noticed Calgary was saying that a lot lately after Phaneuf was moved out of town. But
interesting, you know, because you hear. I mean, none of us is in the Calgary locker room, so it's hard to comment on it. But certainly, you hear different things about different players and different qualities about different players and personalities in a locker room. And I think probably I heard the same things that you guys did, that there was maybe a little too much emphasis on one or two players on the Calgary Flames, and Dion Phaneuf and Olli Jokinen and another one. And you know, I've heard the same thing in two different areas now, three different teams now for Olli Jokinen. he wasn't a great team guy in Florida, from what I heard and from what I witnessed firsthand on a couple of occasions. He just struck me as a bit of an odd duck and somebody that would be hard to get along with and deal with on an everyday basis in a locker room, in a team environment. He got shipped out of Phoenix in an awful hurry, and he didn't last in Calgary. And from what I heard in Calgary was they needed to get him out of the room, and perhaps they needed to get Dion Phaneuf out of the room as well. And now that those two players are gone, guess what they're emphasizing? They're emphasizing the team concept.
I know it's really hard to quantify the team concept, but do you think in Ottawa particularly, it's just more so a something that happened because the core has grown up together? Obviously, some pieces have departed, but do you think that the consistency of the core players in Ottawa has really helped bring home that team concept?
Yeah, I do, and that's another good point that you bring up here, because there are seven or eight, maybe as many as 10 guys on this team. I don't have a roster in front of me, but you know, when you take a look at the Chris Phillips and Anton Volchenkov to perhaps a bit of a lesser extent, but this is a young man who leads by example, and he's been on this club 7 or 8 years now, so he's part of the core. Chris Kelly signing a new contract, Brian Murray said, you know, he's a core player. Well, there's no question. His leadership on and off the ice makes him a core player. Jason Spezza is somebody who I think a lot of people don't realize just how much he does for this team off the ice, how many functions he organizes off the ice, and it's so important to have somebody to want to do that. You don't have to wear a letter to take it upon yourself to say, hey, fellas, it's movie night at my place on the day off, or it's, you know, we're getting together and we're playing poker up in my room when we're in Boston or whatever. It's little things like that that certain players do very well, and it all adds up to the big picture of, you know, the wins and losses, but winning as a team. You need players like that, and those are those core players and guys who have grown up together, you're right, grown up together and enjoyed each other's company and play for each other. Chris Neal, Mike Fisher, Chris Kelly, Chris Phillips, Daniel Alfredson, and then you integrate in some of the younger players like a Nick Foligno and to a lesser extent now Erik Karlsson, Matt Kerkner, invaluable on this hockey club the way he plays for his teammates. It's a fascinating process, and there's so much more that just goes into dropping the puck or lacing up the skates and dropping the puck because you're and playing on the ice because you're wearing the same uniform as a teammate. These guys, it's a good point that you bring up in that they've grown up together and really do care about each other.
You mentioned a bit earlier that the Olympic break might not have come at the best time for the Senators. Tim and I voiced concern on the website that maybe the Senators have peaked maybe a little bit too early, and this Olympic break might make them compound the problem. But one guy who we think the break might be good for is Pascal Leclaire. And I know Tim and I looked at the New York Islanders game and said, well, that might be a perfect opportunity for him to start. But then we read Corey Kluson's comments in the paper, and it made perfect sense why you'd sit him out and bring him back fresh for the last, what, like 17 games or
19.
Something?
Yeah, 19
games, yeah.
So what do you expect of Pascal Leclaire going forward?
Well, it's funny that you bring him up right now, because going into that Islander game on Sunday, after the 4-1 loss in Detroit, I thought the first two goals were not great goals on Brian Elliott. He just looked a little bit off, and then I look back at the week before where he gave up a bad goal against the Leafs in a disastrous game, and it's ignorant of me to point out one goal on one player when the entire team laid an egg against the Toronto Maple Leafs. But I look at that, I look at the Luke Shen goal against Brian Elliott. It was not a good goal. He bounced back and had a huge game against Calgary. The Thursday night Washington game, he scored a 6-5 victory, yet we're complaining about one or two of the goals that went in on him there. Detroit game, I wasn't crazy about a couple of the goals. So I'm looking at four games that Brian Elliott played in a row, and three of them there was a questionable goal. And so my thought process going in was probably, Graham, the same as yours. What a great opportunity now to get Pascal Leclaire in nets on a game that's less than 24 hours after the 3-1 or 4-1 loss to Detroit. And he hasn't played since the 12th of January, and bunch of us were standing around, those of us who travel with the team, before meeting with Corey Clouston, we were standing in the lobby of the hotel, and I looked at, I think, Donnie Brennan and said, I will be shocked if Pascal Leclerc is not starting in goal today. And I think a couple of other guys, maybe Dean, agreed and said, oh, yeah, it's got to be Pascal. And Corey Clouston quickly, I mean, with the first question we ask him, because he doesn't announce his goalie until the day of, the first question that's asked is, who's your starter? And his response was Brian. And we all kind of did a double take and took a step back. And he looked at all of us, and I think he thought perhaps we were anticipating it would be Pascal. And you're right. What he said, what he had quoted in the paper, was so logical and so smart. And so I very quickly, and one of the things that he said was, well, Brian in the past has had an ability to play very well in the second game of back-to-backers. So I very quickly took a look at all the games, and I think that was the ninth scenario where the Senators had played two games in 2 days. Brian Elliott had been a part of eight of them, and his record going into Sunday's game against Long Island was 4-1 in the second game of back-to-backers, whether he had played the night before or not. So now he's now 5-1 in nine back-to-backers in the second game of those back-to-backers. So the coach looked at everything, and one of them was, Brian has had an ability to bounce back. Well, he bounced back in a big way. I think we named him a game star in our broadcast. He was that good. He kept the team in it. Even though he gave up three goals, he kept the team in that game, and they were able to come back and score the 4-3 victory. As far as Pascal is, and then Corey Clouston also said, you know, it's going to be a fresh start for everybody. We've got a bit of a mini camp, and Pascal's got to find his game again. He's going to bring in, the coach is going to bring in John Stevenson, a friend of his who's a goalie coach from out west, and John will work with the goaltenders again for a couple of days during this break and help Pascal rediscover his game a little bit. I think one of the things Pascal has to do, though, is I certainly won't say reinvent himself, but he's got to commit himself to the practice ice, and he's got to get rid of a couple of bad habits and really, really commit himself to working himself back into the spot that he should be in, and that's the number one goaltender on this team. And that's not to take anything away from Elliott. Good on Brian Elliott. I mean, he's faced a challenge, and he's stared down this challenge. You want to talk about resiliency and adversity and everything else? Well, Brian Elliott's the poster child for that, and look what he's done. Look what Brian Elliott has done here and helped this team get to third place in the Eastern Conference. And he is a major, major reason why. And you know, it's funny, and I'm sorry I'm gassing on here, but I got great thoughts here.
We love it. Keep going.
No, I apologize for this, but it's funny because, now I've lost my train of thought. you know, after the Saturday night game, after the 4-1 loss to Detroit, my response was, oh, it's got to be Pascal Leclerc. Like, we're on the bus going to the airport and talking amongst ourselves, and I said, oh, it's got to be Pascal Leclerc tomorrow. And then I followed it up by saying, but the bigger question is, who starts March 2nd? Who starts the game right after the break against the New York Rangers? No, they're not going to call up Mike Brodeur to recapture that magic. But who does get the start? Well, I fresh start or not for everybody, and after a mini training camp, the start belongs to Brian Elliott. Brian Elliott right now is the number one goaltender on this team. No ifs, ands, or buts. This is a young 22 victories of the 35 that the Senators have, or 36 that they have. He deserves to be anointed the number one goaltender until Pascal Leclerc shows that he wants to take it away from him and proves that he can take it away from him.
From the sounds of it, it sounds like the 2007-2008 season all over again, where you have Gerber, who might not exactly be as heralded as Ray Emery's ceiling, but he's still getting the starts because it's weird that you mentioned practice work habits.
Well, it's an interesting point that you pick up, and it's not so much. Don't get me wrong here. I'm not describing Pascal Leclerc and what he does on the practice ice. I'm not comparing what he does on the practice ice to what Ray Emery did.
Good to hear.
The year after, not even close. What Ray Emery did was as unprofessional as I've ever seen in the 18 years I've been covering this and covering professional athletes, not just at an NHL rink, but on a football field or wherever. That was as unprofessional, in my opinion. I work up more of a sweat in the stands watching practice than Ray Emery did on the ice going through practice. That's how disappointing and, in my opinion, appalling it was. And that's why John Paddock lost his job and this team lost its way, and lost its way for a good solid year before finding their way again. And it all started on the practice ice. They lost their way on the practice ice. Corey Clustem helped them find their way again on the practice ice. But please don't misconstrue what I said about LeClaire and perhaps bad habits. Bad habits meaning, you know, going down in your butterfly, and instead of getting up on your right leg, you get up on your soft leg or your back leg. I mean, there are just little things, little tiny things that need to be corrected, that have crept in, I think, a little bit to his game. And far be it from me to, you know, these are just little things that I've noticed in practice. You know, shots coming in, and instead of following the puck into your body, just letting it hit your chest and bounce back out. Well, you know what? You play only as good as you practice. You have to take, as a goalie, you have to approach every shot as if it's a shot that's in a game, and you have to play it as such. And if you don't, you have a tendency, or some goalies might have a tendency to do that too often. And the next thing you know, it's happening in a game, and it can't happen in a game because you're going to get burned in a game.
So going from unprofessional to someone who certainly defines professionalism, even though I don't know the guy personally, Jonathan Chichu, recently waived by the Senators, cleared waivers, and now I believe he's on a two-week hiatus in Bingo right now. Gord, is he done with the big club? Will we ever see Chichu again in the Senators uniform?
My own personal opinion is if he can go back after, I mean, he went down to Binghamton on Sunday. He played one game for Binghamton, scored a goal and an assist, and then in a very classy and professional way, Brian Murray said, and this is one good thing. This is one of the many good things about Brian Murray. I mean, you could describe him almost as a player's GM, and that Jonathan Chichu is an NHL pro and deserves to be called an NHL pro. And so getting waived on the last opportunity or the last day before the Olympic break meant that he was going to have to, or any player was going to have to, if you get waived and you don't get picked up, go down to the minor league team and play throughout the break. Well, it wasn't expected. Jonathan Chichu, I don't think, expected it, and certainly knew that his time was going to be off, and he and his family booked some time off, and they booked a holiday. And Brian Murray, I mean, any general manager could simply say, you know what, you're down in Bingo, and too bad about your holiday, it's got to be canceled. Well, Brian Murray didn't do that. He allowed Jonathan and his wife to go on the vacation that they were on. Jonathan will report back to Binghamton when his holiday is over, and depending on what he does down there, if he can find the back of the net, you know, with regularity, he may get another sniff up with the big club. If he can't, then it's likely his days with the big club are done. So to answer your question, I'm going to be very frank and honest and say I think his days are done with the Ottawa Senators.
Gord, a couple weeks ago, Melnick came out and he had that little media scrum with the media here in Ottawa, and he said Ottawa, in his own opinion, was a contender and that they go deep into the playoffs. And at the time, many of us, like myself and Tim, kind of laughed and thought it was just Melnick being Melnick.
Well, he did promise people on the Team 1200, did he not?
Yeah. But now that the team's gone on a winning streak that not many people saw coming, he's gone forward and he's put Chichu's salary in the minors. And I guess this is a strong message by Melnick to the fans, that saying he wants to win now. Do you have any comments?
Well, I think the owner is certainly committed to winning, and I think, you know, you guys compared some of the things that have happened to a couple of years ago, and I think it's easy enough now to look back at 06-07 when the team went to the Stanley Cup. It was back in November of that year that I think November, early December, the Senators were wallowing around the 500 mark, and everybody was calling for Brian Murray's head. Games passed him by, he can't coach anymore, fire the coach, make a replacement now. And Mr. Melnick came out and said, you know what, vote of confidence for this coach, vote of confidence for the players that we have, and let's see what they can do because I believe in them. And sometimes that means an awful lot to the players. Nobody likes to change. Nobody likes to move. Nobody likes to get traded. unless you're a dink. And I can't recall over the years too many dinks on this hockey club. And so that being said, sometimes it takes an owner to come out and say, hold off here, you know, just relax. Let's just take a deep breath, take a step back. And it's the owner's prerogative, it's anybody's prerogative to make a prediction, okay? Predictions are like belly buttons. Everybody has opinions or whatever. Everybody has one and can express it if you like. On a couple of occasions now, you're right, Mr. Melnyk has made predictions. Well, back in 06-07, he made the bold prediction that the Senators were going to be okay, everybody should take a step back, and guess what they did? They turned things around. Nobody anticipated that coming either, and they went all the way to the Stanley Cup Final. I think one of the things that you have seen since Mr. Melnyk's comments this time around is this team has beaten the Washington Capitals. It's beaten the New Jersey Devils. It's beaten the Buffalo Sabres three or four times. It's beaten the Pittsburgh Penguins. It's beaten just about every team that's been ahead of them in the standings. And it's done so without the captain. It's done so without Spezza. It's done so without Milan Mikolic for a good deal of time, without Filip Kuba, without Anton Volchenkov, without Chris Neal for 15 games. This team has gone through its share of injuries, yet it's continued to be consistent enough to win or be close to winning hockey games. But now that you can say winners of 14 of their last 16 games, and they've beaten some pretty top-notch hockey clubs, you know what? I think it's safe to say that they're in the mix as being a contender in the National Hockey League for a Stanley Cup. I really do. And 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, there wasn't a chance I would have said that. Not even close to being comfortable in even thinking that. But now, having watched the way the team has played and how it's gone about winning games, and the 4-3 win against the Islanders is just an example. Down 3-1 after two. Oh, well, you know what? We better start playing again. And I guess Corey's message at the end of the second period was get back to the game plan here. And they started off like a house on fire. Their first period against the Islanders was terrific. Tied 1-1. They let the foot off the gas pedal, and you know, understandably so. They played the night before. They thought the game maybe was going to be a little bit easier than it was. The Islanders score a couple of quick goals. It's 3-1. Well, you know what? They've got enough guys that when they want to seriously play, they can really dominate a game. And you saw Alex Kovalev dominate that third period the other day. And because of that, because of the consistent goaltending that they're getting, because of the way defensemen play, and I'm going to say because the way Filip Kuba play, I mean, Chris Phillips and Anton Volchenkov are an outstanding, solid 1-2 shutdown tandem. Then you combine Filip Kuba and Erik Karlsson, the way they were playing down the stretch before Karlsson got hurt, and you got a real solid four back end. And Brian Murray's still not finished. I think he wants to add another defenseman before all is said and done. And it'll make for a very, very interesting finish, to say the least.
Well, the Senators got off to an early start relative to a lot of teams before the trade deadline this year. How do you like Matt Cullen as a fit in Ottawa?
I think he's going to be a nice fit. I think it's too hard to tell in the first two games, back-to-back games. He didn't get in until, I think, 3 in the morning prior to the Detroit game. So, and then got thrown to the Wolves by having to play with, I think, probably 7 or 8 of the 12 forwards or 11 other forwards involved. So not much chemistry developed. The mini camp is going to be terrific for him, and I think that's one of the main reasons why Brian Murray made the deal when he did, because he could. He's taken on some salary here and really unnecessary salary. This team could have gone on without Matt Cullen against Detroit and against the New York Islanders, but the deal was there, and Brian Murray jumped on it. I think, and from by all accounts, and in talking to him briefly Saturday morning in Detroit, salt of the earth individual. I've heard nothing but good things about him as a person, and so it'll be fun to watch him mix. I know the players were excited about getting him. Anytime you can add a player who's won a cup or two and has experience and skill like Matt Cullen does, other players around him are going to be pretty excited about it. And I think this team as a whole is a better club with Matt Cullen in the lineup for sure.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good indication. I remember when Kovalev was brought into town, Daniel Alfredson said that he was one of the, top two or three players in the NHL. And to me, that said more than anything else about Kovalev's past, his stats, and his means of play.
Yeah, and now take a look at Alex Kovalev. And I know we all complained about the start that he had and wondered why he had the start that he had. But now he's got points in 16 of the 18 games or 14 of the 16 games. I did the numbers on the plane on the way home. Over this streak, Alex Kovalev is a big reason why this team has won the majority of its games. Kovalev has points, I believe, in 14 of his last 16 games. And some key big points. And I think players around him are finding it a little easier, perhaps, and playing with him. And he's going to be dynamite to watch in the final 19 games. This break for him, and remember, he's 37 at the end of this month, this break for him is going to be very, very much needed and refreshing. And that's not to say that, you know, he's exhausted and dead on his feet. He's a guy in terrific shape, but just mentally, it's going to be a real fun team to watch down the stretch, I think, anyway. The whole NHL, I think, is going to be really, really fascinating to watch because this Olympic break can have an effect on so many teams. The Anaheim Ducks on the verge of making the playoffs here, but still on the outside looking at seven players in the Olympics. I mean, how is that going to affect their team, depending on you know, how far some players go. Corey Perry and Getzlaff could go all the way to the gold medal and be absolutely exhausted by the end of it. The same holds true for perhaps Daniel Alfredson. He's a different breed, though. He's as, you know, as mentally and physically tough as anybody. So it'll be interesting. I'm really looking forward to the 1st of March for sure.
Hopefully no one pulls an adductor injury while they're over there.
No kidding. You know what? Probably cost the Senators their first Stanley Cup.
Yeah,
probably
Tim and I were saying that too.
Yeah, that's not the first time that's come up between us.
Even the lockout, had the lockout not taken place that year, the Olympics never would have happened and Ottawa might have had a shot.
Yeah, for sure.
It's just one of those what-if questions. But, Gord, before you go, Tim and I have had many conversations regarding Brian Lee and his future in Ottawa, and he just seems to be one of those players who can never stick. And, like, we're not really sure whether it's his talent level, his attitude, his contract, because it's a two-way contract, and Campoli and Picard didn't have that. What are your thoughts of Brian Lee, and do you see him maybe being a trade chip as the deadline approaches?
Yeah, probably. I think I wouldn't be surprised if he gets traded. I'm not sure if the organization has lost its patience in Brian Lee. My own personal opinion is, at 22 years of age, I'd like the organization to keep him around a little bit longer and try and help him develop a little bit longer. But I'm not sure if he has the right attitude to want to do that. And then you factor in the skill level, and it's not where it should be right now. And just watching him in the last two games, and I'm a Brian Lee supporter and a bit of a fan of Brian Lee's, only because I think the expectations are way too high. It wasn't his fault that he was drafted 9th overall, okay, and probably was drafted too high, but not his fault. It's unfortunate that for young players, it takes a little longer sometimes for that message to click in, that, you know what, I'm going to have to work a little harder at my game. And I think that might be the case for Brian. I think it's pretty, I mean, he doesn't have an NHL shot right now. I can't remember the last time I saw him take a slap shot. And a right shot defenseman, there are so many clubs screaming for right shot defensemen who can shoot the puck. And if you're not going to get anything but a wrister from 60 feet out, well, heaven's sakes, fellas, we could stop it if we strapped on the pad. It's too bad.
You're giving Tim too much credit.
Yeah, okay, myself too. I close my eyes and hope it hits me, but I'm sure it's going to hit me and probably not hurt me. That's the sad part about it. I mean, you got to get your shot going here. if you want to stand a chance. I mean, Matt Kartner has a shot and a half. Alex Picard has a wonderful shot, a spectacular shot. And Brian just hasn't found his yet or developed his yet. And until he does, I think there's going to be always that question mark about whether he's going to be good enough to play or not. But at 22, I'd hate to see the organization, and I think they're probably going to, but that's just a guess on my part. But I hate watching underdeveloped first-round picks leave the nest, if you will, or too early.
I completely agree with you. I've been a Brian Lee fan for a long time, and quite frankly, recently I've gotten tired of explaining myself.
Yeah,
I kept hoping after every AHL stint he'd come back and play better, but it just never quite happened for him.
But you know what, and Tim, it's a good point that you bring up here again, and I think I had this discussion after the Islander game to members of the media, and my question was, what are your expectations of this guy? He's 22. Did you expect that coming from Binghamton he was going to light up the world here in his first game back? I mean, he's going to be nervous as well. He's going to have the jitters, and he's going to play, with some trepidation, and we shouldn't expect him to be jumping into the rush every time he gets the puck or making those perfect tape-to-tape 55-foot passes. You just shouldn't. It doesn't happen with Philip Kuba. It doesn't happen with Chris Phillips. It doesn't happen with Volchenkov every shift. Why should we expect it to have happen with Brian Lee? And I think that's the prevailing winds in Ottawa are, this guy's got to do more. Well, I think, you know what, we got to give him a chance to do more as well. But that's where I believe attitude may come in and play a role in his development or underdevelopment, unfortunately. My own personal thought, and that's just a guess on my part because I don't know what he's like in Binghamton. I do know that he has struggled a little bit, though, in Binghamton, and he shouldn't. Really, he shouldn't struggle in Binghamton.
All right, Gord, I've got a few quick questions for you. I guess we can call them goodies for Gord, maybe. Just some rapid-fire type questions. Don't want to steal anyone's lines here.
Hey, just one sec here, fellas. I got to remind my daughter that Survivor's on.
No problem.
Yeah, Survivor's on now, Lindsay. Okay, sorry, guys.
It's the All-Stars, right?
Hey, it's the villains versus the good guys, the heroes.
Reality TV hockey.
And Team Canada's playing as well, Lindsay. I mean, anyway, sorry, fellas.
Yeah, we had our passports revoked when we came in to do the show and not watch the game.
No, there you go.
Some guy was tearing them up outside. So my first question for you, Gord. This is a very cliche question, I'm sure, but what has been your favorite game or series to call?
Oh, favorite game or series to call?
Yep.
Holy smokes. Well, I would certainly have to say Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Final ranks right up there. That whole series ranks right up there. And I learned the hard way why it's called a final. I mean, it's the finality of it all is, if you don't win, is as depressing and as depressing can be. I mean, it was, there are two teams, and one wins and one loses, and one finishes up and goes home, and the other gets to, yes, go home, but go home in a celebratory manner. So that series was an interesting one, and certainly one that I'll cherish, you know, for the rest of my career and rest of my life. It was a fascinating one. I had a most enjoyable. There were going into the Stanley Cup Final as well. The Buffalo series was a wild one. The Senators won it in five games, but they also won a couple of key overtime games. The Joe Corvo goal in double overtime was outstanding, and then Alfredson's goal in the fifth game in overtime to send the Senators to the Cup was probably the greatest game. There was one other one, too, that I'm thinking of, only because I really have a lot of time for this professional. Chris Phillips is a salt-of-the-earth pro and individual away from the rink, and his goal in Game 6 of the conference final against New Jersey a couple of years ago when Senators were down 3-1. I can remember going on Team 1200 in the morning and saying, oh, this is the start of the greatest comeback week in Senators history. And they kind of laughed at me. And then the next thing you know, the Senators won the fifth game. And then they went into New Jersey and Chris Phillips scored the winner in overtime to make it 3-3. And then, obviously, the Senators had to come home for Game 7, and they lost that. And, you know, it's funny because Marian Hossa was on fire in the first period of that game, and he could do no wrong. And who was it? Was it Jeff Friesen who scored the winner with about 2.5 minutes to go to give the Devils a 3-2 lead? And then Marian Hossa came back, and in the final 20 seconds or so, he had two or three bodies all over him and couldn't put the puck in the back, and then had to force the overtime. But that was probably one of the more memorable series as well for me, Senators-Devils series for the Eastern Final a couple of years ago.
Gordon, in the infamous Senators-Flyers brawl on March 5th, 2004, what was your favorite fight?
Oh, the goalies. I mean, holy smokes. Patrick Laleem and Robert Esch, it was outstanding. And just the way, I mean, there's nothing better than a goalie sprinting down the ice to go and get the other guy. And because you can hear the clunking of the skates and the heavy legs, and Patty Laleem from one end of the ice down to the other, race down to combat with Robert Esch. It was a classic for sure. There's nothing better, fellas, than a good goalie fight. I mean, when you think of Yanni Hermé and Felix Potvin at Scotiabank Place, I mean, that was, and Hermé couldn't get his trapper off, and he had to reach into the Ottawa bench, and I think it was Todd White who had to undo a strap for him.
One of my favorite moments.
Mine too, without question.
Without using a qualitative measurement.
You like to think I know what that is.
How hard is Mike Fisher's shot?
Oh, you know, I speak firsthand because I'm a goalie, and I helped him rehab one summer. How stupid is this? I went out in the ice and took shots, and he shoots to hurt. And I've said this to him. I said, you know what? If you just took a little off your shot, Mike, you'd be a 45 goal scorer. Just, you don't have to hurt the goalie every time you shoot. He shoots to hurt. I'm not kidding you. It's as hard as anything. It's insane, and it goes right through you. And I don't care. I mean, Dean and I have had this argument. Oh, you got pads on. You got all this equipment on. You know what? If it misses the blocker, that way you can feel it right through every pad. Right through every pad. It hurts. It's hard. Yeah.
All right, so a couple, past players here. I'm just going to read off a few names, and if you wouldn't mind just stating the first few things that come to your mind about the individual, that'd be great. So the first one is Denny Vial.
Tough as nails, and the first thing that comes to mind is walking by him in, I hate to say this, but in the shower at the old stadium in Chicago, and he had just taken a puck in the face, and he was split wide open across his cheek. And he was in a panic. He was out of the shower, but he was in a panic because he didn't want to hold up the team because we were leaving, and I think there was another city to go to, and he was in a panic. The stitches had started to come through and come out, and he was seeping blood, and all he could think of was holding up his teammates. Denny Vial, tough as nails.
Jason Zent.
Wrister and a half and fear of flying. He wasn't a big flyer. Jason Zent, is that who you're thinking of?
Yeah, sorry,
I thought you said Vent. Jason Zent, yeah, and wrister, he could put the puck top corner from center ice. He had a heck of a wrister.
Yeah, we kind of speculated that would come out.
Yeah, and a bit of a fear of flying. I remember sitting beside him in a commercial flight and had to talk to him the whole time. My voice was gone by the time I had to broadcast the next game.
Number three, Sean McEachern.
Sean McEachern, a great guy, first of all. I consider him a real good friend, a very tough interview. The most personable guy away from a microphone, but you get him in front of a microphone, and he's all business, and unfortunately his business is short and sweet, and he was a one-word answer guy, which made it very difficult on the guy who was asking the questions, which was usually me. And more often than not, and back in the days when I was doing TV, our producer at the time would come into town once or twice a month or a couple of times a month, and every second broadcast. He was a big McEachern fan as well and wanted me to talk to Sean, do an interview with Sean, and it just killed me. And I talked to him, you know, I don't want to say on a regular basis, but talked to him in the summer months when I was traveling to Boston, and had dinner with him in Boston, and yeah, he's a good guy and a very easy personality to talk to, except when he's got a microphone in his face.
Mark Lamb.
Chopper. You know what? It's been so long. I don't know.
Chopper works.
Yeah, good guy. Yeah, I mean he was a good guy. It was back in the early years. I mean it was painful for everybody involved. So I'm sure his time in Ottawa was a bit difficult.
I'd be doing my old man a big injustice if I didn't throw this name out to you, Bruce Gardner.
10 year. He always acted like he was in the league 10 years. Apparently, that's how he got the nickname 10 year. You know what? Interesting individual. Outspoken and certainly had personality. And obviously, the stick in the toilet incident when he was going through a slump and needed to score some goals in trying to do anything indicated that he did and certainly does have lots of personality.
Dean Brown.
Truly great one.
There you go.
A classic.
Nailed it.
A classic. And you know what? Probably the best and most, probably the best broadcaster, I would say top three broadcasters in Canada, if not North America. This guy could do any sport on any network, in my opinion. And if you guys, and certainly I would share these thoughts, think he's good at hockey, you should hear his football. And if you can remember his football, if you ever did hear it, I think personally he really, really could have taken off and gone places football-wise, certainly could hockey-wise, but one of the best broadcasters I've ever had the pleasure of knowing and working with. But a bit of a goof. I mean, you know, he's...
Tim's shedding a tear right now.
Oh, please don't. Like I said, a bit of a goof. No, real good friend, for sure.
I'm still laughing from tenure.
Yeah, there's a few other things, you know. Well, never mind. I won't get into that.
All right, Gord. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming aboard the podcast. I hope you had a good time. I know Tim really enjoyed it, and it was nice to get a chance to know you a bit.
I loved it. Thank you very much for having me, and let's do this again. It's a pleasure to be able to come on and not have to worry about the time and be able to talk some puck. There's no question about it. It's a passion of mine, and I would certainly like to do this anytime you want.
I had no idea coming into this I'd be laughing so much. That was the last thing I expected, but it's been great. We really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure, fellas. Thanks for having me.
Known coming into that interview that Gord Wilson would have dropped the word dink.
Not me. That surprised the hell out of me, that whole interview.
Made my night. That was fantastic.
You can tell the guy makes a living being on the radio because he is damn good at it.
That was
40 minutes of awesomeness.
I think he thought I was fluffing him a little bit there, but it was all sincere.
I told you he would talk about Jason Zent's release point.
Yeah, and the guy is the voice of the Ottawa Senators, right?
It's fantastic.
It's like Jim Houston out in Vancouver. You just know when you hear it. Yeah. That's how it is. And we didn't even get to ask him about the roundtable before the game.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's true, too.
Next time, even more reason to have him back.
Yeah, he said he'd come back. But we hope you guys enjoyed the show. We'll catch you next week. Take care. It's like 2 a.m. and it's Tuesday. Taking pictures in the streets. We were wearing kitten masks. We were wearing kitten masks. Got no shame cause we're alone. We're teenagers, we don't care. No one's around, or so it seems. No one's around, or so it seems. The streets of Paris, man it's crazy. The streets of Paris, c'est la folie. The streets of Paris, man it's crazy. The streets of Paris, c'est la folie. Then we notice four guys there, riding bikes and talking loud. They were wearing Nike caps. They were wearing Nike caps. When they saw us,